Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, we'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Whether you're tuning in live or catching us later, stay ahead with stories that really matter. Coming up on the program, business increasingly worried over the GNU impasse, the real impact of US tariffs. I'll give you a sobering view from the Eastern Cape. The private security industry is under fire. There are concerns over new regulations, and mental health is still being treated as an afterthought in corporate South Africa. It's Monday, the 7th of April. The Nelson Mandela Bay Business Chamber expressing deep concern over the potential ramifications of the proposed 25% increase in US tariffs on South Africa's automotive exports. There is a warning today that such tariffs could swiftly lead to the loss of many essential direct jobs in the Eastern Cape's automotive sector. So I want to bring you a broad perspective on this now. I'm in conversation with Denise Van Hastien, who is Chief Executive Officer at the Chamber. Denise, a very warm welcome to you. And maybe just some numbers, first of all. How significant is the US market for Eastern Cape and the automotive export sector?
First of all, it's not so much about the US market, it's also about a global market. So this has far wider ramifications. But if you look at the auto industry as a whole, the US is the second biggest trading partner for the automotive industry from an exports perspective. But when you look at the impact, you have to also dissect, it's not just those manufacturers that supply vehicles direct to the US or components direct to the US. It's also others in the supply chain that will be affected because of global decisions that get made by other countries in response to what the US is doing. So you're looking at risk of manufacturing footprints changing around the world as countries protect themselves. You know, and you can imagine now in boardrooms around the world, they're making decisions on what are the best locations to manufacture. And when you look at South Africa, we only 0.6% of global vehicle manufacturing. So it puts us in a very difficult position.
Have you done any quantification as far as impact on the local economy is concerned and also jobs?
So we're busy doing a assessment at the moment, and we're busy digging into the entire ecosystem. And I think that's also important to understand. When you have automotive manufacturing in a country, it's actually a privilege because the ecosystem around it is huge. So aside from your vehicle manufacturers, you have components like brake pads, tires, catalytic converters, you name it, that is produced for the vehicles. And then it also has a knock-on impact to services sectors and so on. So we're busy undertaking that assessment because we're very concerned in terms of the disproportionate impact on Nelson Mandela Bay, because our economy, we actually have almost half of the country's automotive manufacturing is located here, and also 41% of the country's automotive manufacturing employment. So that puts us in a very high risk situation.
And exacerbated, of course, by the fact that the region and the city, the metro, is under severe economic strain even before these tariffs were announced.
Absolutely. And I think you also have to backtrack to just before COVID, where the auto industry levels, we haven't returned yet to those volumes that we saw previously. And then you've also had a lot of vehicle imports flooding the market, which has put pressure on domestic producers, where their volumes in the local market have shrunk even more. And for their business models to work, they need a balance of exports as well as local sales market. So the industry has been going through tough times. We've also had logistics issues which continue around the ports and rail. And then, of course, the energy crisis had a huge impact on our manufacturing sector. So it's been a tough few years. I think the sector has been relatively resilient, but we have seen some closures starting to take place now and job losses, unfortunately.
Is it too early to start talking about strategy for local business in order to mitigate the impact of these proposed tariffs?
No, we need to move with speed, and there needs to be absolute urgency to look at the mitigation initiatives. And if you take a look at the tariffs that have been imposed and you look at countries on this continent, we're in a very disadvantaged position versus, for example, Morocco and Egypt, which are much closer to the markets. They've only been slapped with a 10% tariff. And then if you look at the African Continental Free Trade Agreement, from an auto industry perspective, that hasn't yet been unlocked because the rules of origin have not been finalized. And you also have grey imports that flood the markets. Until that changes, you won't have a new vehicle market in those countries. But we're at a risk of becoming less competitive versus other African markets. And manufacturers could make decisions to rather manufacture in Egypt or Morocco, where it's more preferential. So there's a lot of risk that we face right now, and we urgently need to look at mitigation. And for example, if you look at the BRICS markets, people talk about diversification, but right now we don't have any free trade agreements with the BRICS markets, so that should be a priority. Southeast Asia markets, European Union, they're a very important trading partner for us. So we need to be strengthening those relationships right now. Those are just some of the things we should be doing. But I think the speed at which this is moving, I don't know if people in the country realize just how fast it's moving. And we really need to move fast if we want to preserve manufacturing.
Denise, is there a general sense of despondency among your constituency? You spoke about the sector particularly being resilient in the past, but this is potentially a huge body blow, isn't it?
Look, I think we're all highly concerned, but we're rallying together. Our biggest strength here is our united business community, where we're very unified in our approach. And what we've already started about 2 years ago is we launched a local economy reinvention think tank, because we realized that the local manufacturing sector needs to be reinvented if it is to survive. And we've been working on various projects in that think tank, and we are going to accelerate our efforts, but we also need the various stakeholders to come on board. And really, I think the enabling environment is key as well, where we need the basics to work. If you want to keep manufacturing in the country, you need power, you need service delivery to happen, and you need the logistics to be efficient, especially given our disadvantage in terms of how far we are from the global markets.
Just a quick one in conclusion. What is the Chamber's call to provincial and national government in this respect?
Well, I think what we're looking for is absolute urgency in terms of grappling the issue and its implications for the province and also for the city. And we need them to partner with us in getting mitigation initiatives in place. We need to push hard for grey imports, for example, to be banned on the continent. We need to accelerate efforts around other markets. And we also need to look at how we can strengthen relationships again with the US as a trading partner. We need to try everything we can so we don't lose markets.
I'm going to leave it there. Denise Van Hastien, thank you very much indeed. Chief Executive Officer, Nelson Mandela Bay Chamber of Commerce.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Business in South Africa is increasingly concerned over the new tensions in the Government of National Unity. So my question today is, how closely is this impasse right now going to impact on the body politic, given that all of this is before the courts? And perhaps more importantly, what type of outcome is needed as far as business is concerned? Martin Kingston is with Business for South Africa. He's the chair. It's an alliance, as you know, of South African business leaders working with the government and other social partners to step up, lead, and help create a deliverable and sustainable solution for South Africa. Martin, a very warm welcome to you. And maybe let's start with your temperature reading. How concerned is business right now about developments within the GNU?
So I think the business is very concerned. We're concerned about the global macro environment. I'm sure we'll come on to that. We've got unprecedented levels of volatility and unpredictability. And the same goes, obviously, for any tensions within the Government of National Unity. We, as business, welcomed it when it was announced. We want to crowd in as many skills and capabilities as we can from wheresoever they can be sourced. BFRSA is, I think, an example of such, as is the partnership with government. And the sooner that we have certainty and we can make sure that we've got all of the requisite skills, you know, supporting the trajectory that you talked about, which is one that has to have as its absolute mantra inclusive growth. And when we talk about inclusive growth, we're talking about inclusive growth well in excess of 3% on a sustained basis. And we're a long way from that. Then that is the most important area of focus for us.
What do you think the impact currently is of the uncertainty that exists?
Well, I think that obviously in any environment such as the one in which we find ourselves, and it's unfortunate that the South African environment now, political environment, is magnified by what we're seeing globally, let alone obviously the US-SA relationship, that people become very skittish. Their concern about their long-term commitments and, you know, the ability to generate jobs, and that's really everybody's primary focus and needs to be that, is a function of economic growth, a function itself of investment, primarily private sector. People sit and they watch what is happening rather than commit, unless they can see through, if you like, the storm. And at the moment, I would argue that people can't. So we would be concerned that any instability, by definition, is removed as a matter of urgency, and that we have that certainty, predictability, and, as I said, a commitment to crowd in skills and expertise in support of the structural adjustment that we need and reform as a country. And that's what we've said consistently since the formation of the partnership.
And as you rightly point out, suddenly those stakes are exponentially higher given the global tariff crisis, fears of a recession, and the world share sell-off that we've seen.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I think nobody is able to predict what is going to happen in the context of what seems to be the beginning of a global tariff war or trade war between very major economic powers. And we, unfortunately, are just going to be the grass that gets trampled on, like so many other countries, particularly in Africa, should that be the case. I mean, if, for the sake of argument, AGOA is not extended beyond September, or indeed if South Africa is not retained within the AGOA structure, there are jobs, and indeed there's an impact on GDP that is at risk. By the same token, we've seen over the last few days extraordinary carnage, is probably the right way to put it, on the stock markets around the world, volatility in the context of currencies. That makes it very difficult for people to take any decisions at all. We need to sort of, you know, hang on. Our focus, of course, is not in the here and now. I mean, our focus is putting in place as business arrangements and processes that can support structural reform, which opens the gateway for more efficient processes in South Africa, and indeed for business to play an appropriate role in spearheading economic growth. And when I say appropriate, you know, with due regard to the role of the state in an appropriately regulated environment. And all of that, I fear, will be the subject of sort of a brake being put on and applied until such time as we have greater certainty as to what is going to emerge, both in respect of the global environment. And I'm not just talking, of course, of the macroeconomic environment, but also the major flashpoints that we know are taking place around the world, be it Russia and Ukraine, be it the Middle East, being some of the civil wars that we're seeing within Africa and the instability there. All of that fundamentally has a major impact upon our ability to take considered decisions and implement them for the medium and the long term.
As far as the GNU is concerned, bringing it back to home, it would seem the waters at the weekend, though, got a little choppier. President Ramaphosa asserting that business can't dictate to government in terms of the direction and the formulation of the GNU. That would be worrying, surely.
Yeah, well, I think that what the president said, of course, is correct. I mean, we would agree with that. I mean, the government must take its own decisions, and ultimately those decisions fall exclusively within the ambit and the responsibility of President Ramaphosa. Business, in my view, is a critical stakeholder. It's proved itself to be such, both during the pandemic, the early days and the vaccination rollout, and over the last 2 years in the partnership with government spanning, as you will know, and we've discussed before, Jeremy, energy, transport and logistics, crime and corruption. We've now included sort of unemployment with a particular focus on youth unemployment at the request of the president. We're now examining water, which may present many of the same challenges as energy and transport and logistics. So we're a stakeholder that is heavily invested, both literally and metaphorically, in the well-being of the country, not only for our businesses, but actually for our children and our grandchildren, and for those that are the most disadvantaged in the country. So do I think that we should use that in an appropriate way? Absolutely not. I think that it's correct that we should demonstrate that we continue to be committed to working with the government of the day. That has been our mantra from the beginning of the partnership, regardless of the outcome of the elections, provided that the government is committed to the same values and reforms as we are, and that is manifest in the government's commitment to Operation Vulindlela 2.0, for example, and the issues that are the subject matter of cooperation in the partnership. It would be absolutely inappropriate for anybody to assume that business should be telling government, this government, a future government or a previous government, what to do. That is not correct.
But difficult for government, I would imagine, and this is a final question, to balance political unity on the one side, and that's the GNU, with economic pragmatism.
Yeah, well, I think that that is a challenge that obviously this government, but many governments face. For us, as for business, economic pragmatism is what actually must, if you like, trump all other considerations. Economic pragmatism that results in, as I said, sustained inclusive economic growth and provides us with a way of dealing with the level of unemployment that currently confronts the country. And I would imagine that that must be, you know, the primary consideration for any government, the one we have today or ones that we'll have in the future, Jeremy.
Martin Kingston, as always, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
South Africa's private security industry is the largest on the continent and I imagine one of the biggest in the world, employing over 500,000 active security officers. If I'm not mistaken, that's about 3 times the size of the SAPS. But now the sector is on edge over proposed amendments to the firearms regulation by the Private Security Industry Regulatory Authority. These new rules could severely limit the use of semi-automatic weapons, restrict access to firearms under investigation, and even impose costly new tracking requirements. Some critics are saying the changes could cripple high-risk security operations that would obviously leave many companies legally and financially exposed. So I want to look at this in a little more detail, what's really at stake here. And I'm talking to Martin Hood, an attorney with MJ Hood & Associates and a specialist in firearms and security law. Martin, a very warm welcome then. So what are your primary concerns around these amendments?
Jeremy, I think we need to start with the simple statement that anything that makes the doing business more difficult and more costly is not good for the South African economy. These proposals create a massive additional administrative burden on security companies to comply with more requirements. That's without talking specifically about the firearm issue. It just creates much more administration for a security company to operate legally. That's the first point. Then we have what the actual proposals contain, the substance, which is very severe restrictions on the use of firearms. And besides lacking any degree of rationality, what it has done is to potentially create a situation where public spaces are no longer going to be protected by private security. And that then in turn will create a more negative perception of South Africa as being more unsafe if these proposals go through. And then that has consequences such as a negative impact on tourism.
So what steps then is the industry taking right now to engage with the regulators on these proposed changes? Or is there something of an impasse here?
No, the very word engage is correct. That's the first step. There's a period for public comment. Various organizations, people such as myself, we are examining the proposals. We are going to provide what we regard as positive inputs so that hopefully we can convince the regulator and the Minister of Police to reconsider these. They're not necessary at this stage. We don't even know what their underlying purpose is. We don't know what the problem is that the regulator is trying to cure. It's a very regulated industry as it is. not properly regulated, but that's the regulator's issue. And now they just want to create even more and more regulation. And you know as well as anybody else does in this country, there's no point in passing more laws when existing laws are not enforced.
Is one of the intentions not to clamp down on so-called fly-by-night operators that might be flouting those regulations that you refer to?
Well, then the regulator must clamp down on those fly-by-night operations. The law's there already. If I can just also just give one perhaps simple example, many of these regulations are mirrored in the regulations to the Firearms Control Act already. They've taken them word for word out of the Firearms Control Act, where they rightfully belong, and put them in the hands of the regulator. So now what they're doing is, instead of the police controlling firearms, which is appropriate, they have the training for it, you're giving a private security inspector who may not even have firearm training, no competency certificate, you're giving him the right to go and control firearms. That's wrong from the point of view that you should not have untrained people accessing firearms. And it's a complete and utter duplication of existing regulations.
What exactly does limiting semi-automatic rifle use mean when it comes to high-risk security operations? What's your understanding of that word limiting?
Well, that's another problem. The word woolly comes to mind. A lot of the wording in these proposals is vague and undefined. And that's a bad principle when it comes to drafting legislation, because when something is not clear and its purpose is not stated, it creates uncertainty. And these regulations create more uncertainty than they do certainty. So I can't tell you what they want to achieve by passing these regulations.
There's also another requirement about restricting or using, and I quote, a reasonable quantity of ammunition. Again, do you have any clarity on that, Martin?
There is no definition of what is a reasonable quantity of ammunition. The challenge that a security environment has is that an emergency situation can arise at very short notice, and you may need a certain amount of ammunition, and let's be clear, non-lethal rubber ammunition is an example which is now prohibited, just by the way. You can't write a letter or send an email to a regulator and say, I actually need to go and buy some more ammunition right now, please give me permission. So you need to keep a quantity in reserve, and you also need it for training purposes. The better trained a security officer is in the use of firearms, the safer they're going to be. And then the regulator comes along and says, oh, you know, we kind of decide how much we think is reasonable for you to have. No guidelines, no explanation as to why they want to do it and how they're going to do it, and therefore uncertainty.
It's not just about ammunition, including rubber bullets, as you say, but if I've read this correctly, it also would entail less lethal tools like tasers.
Well, this is perhaps the part that's the most difficult to comprehend, because they limit the use of less lethal alternatives, which is something that this government has advocated for a long, long time. Rather, do not use the ultimate level of violence, rather use less violence. Now they come along and say, for example, you can't use a taser, which is a specific brand, which doesn't make sense. Why would you ban a specific brand? But they say that, for example, you can't use rubber ammunition, rubber bullets, which is something that's typically used in a crowd situation, which is less lethal or non-lethal. So one of the problems with that is that security officers, instead of having a less lethal alternative, may be forced to use lethal force almost immediately. That doesn't make sense. And just to emphasize the lack of sense and rationality, handcuffs are now what's deemed to be a controlled weapon. You've got to be trained on how to use a handcuff. The regulator has to decide whether you can use handcuffs or not.
So just very quickly in conclusion, I understand the importance of public consideration and engagement, but inevitably this is going to end up in court, isn't it?
I think quite definitely if they're not withdrawn in toto, it will end up in court, because they're unworkable, they're impractical, and they will increase the cost of doing business, which means ultimately that the consumer ends up paying more.
Martin Hood, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
For millions of South Africans, access to healthcare, particularly mental health care, remains a distant hope. Now, listen to these numbers. Despite one third of the population experiencing a mental health condition and more than a quarter affected by depression, only 5% of our national healthcare budget is currently allocated to mental health services. I want to explore that in a little more detail with Professor Renata Skuman, Head of Healthcare Leadership at Stellenbosch Business School. And she has in the past been outspoken about the state of South Africa's mental health care system, and she describes it as being on life support. Professor Skuman, a very warm welcome to you. So the system on life support, what are the most urgent warning signs that you're currently seeing?
Hello, Jeremy. I think if we just look at the national or international reports that's coming out, say, for example, the 2024 Sapien Lab Mental State of the World report revealed that South Africa has a mental health quotient of 50, which means we're ranking 69 out of 71, which is really, really not good. And about 35% of all respondents that took part in the survey are distressed or struggling in terms of their mental health. So when we look at the figures, also what we know about our own stats in South Africa, as you mentioned, more than a quarter of people that's affected by depression and a third affected by mental health conditions, the majority of our population do not have access. They do not seek help. Teen mental health is escalating. But then also, it's not only patients that's negatively affected. We also see that our healthcare service providers are really, we can say, an emotional recession at the moment.
So, Professor, if only 5% of the national health budget is going to mental health, as I mentioned, in real terms, what does this mean for the average South African needing help and also for organizations that have a responsibility to make sure that they have a mentally fit, stable and healthy workforce?
So there's two aspects. I think we need to look at public healthcare, private healthcare, and as you mentioned, organizational health. If these three sectors do not collaborate, we are not going to survive this. Firstly, in the public sector, if we look in global terms, we spend about 8 to 9% of our GDP on health, which is relatively high, but the system is incredibly inefficient and underperforming, and it's not a lack of funds. It's about how these funds are used. We know there's inefficiency, corruption, mismanagement, and most of the budget this year, again, just going to be allocated to salaries and not really improving infrastructure. In the private healthcare system, things are not really better. Maybe you can get hold of someone, but even there, the mental health space is severely neglected. On the most of the medical schemes, you may be lucky to get two consultations a year. And if it's a prescribed minimum benefit condition, there will be more access to care. But there's only about depression and schizophrenia that's being covered. What about all the other mental health conditions? And then thirdly, if we look at the workforce, and we know that a previous study that dates back to 2016 showed that about 40 billion rand at that stage was going lost every year due to presenteeism at work. So people being mentally unwell, but they are at work because they don't have an option. They don't have access to care. So we really need to look from an organizational level as well, how we can keep our workforce mentally healthy. Because once they're ill, we can't depend on a sick care system. We don't really truly have a healthcare system. We're just providing for the sick and not to keep people healthy.
So what impact then, particularly in the private sector, does this have on productivity and I guess even profitability?
Yeah, no, the consequences are significant. As I mentioned, the financial impact, which in 2016, there isn't an update, unfortunately, but we can do the stats. It's more than the tourism budget. It's more than all the SASSA grants. So how can we care and just in terms of that, to expand that if we can't even keep our workforce healthy? We know that there's increased absenteeism ranging between 23 days and even upward in certain health conditions. Also, in the private sector, many people only can get access as inpatient treatment. And I think that's a big negative, is that we're driving hospital-based care instead of supporting people to be outpatients and have that flexibility at work to be able to attend a therapeutic appointment or an appointment with a psychiatrist. So there's absenteeism, retraining people is expensive to recruit new people. It's the lack of productivity that we see. So all of that have a huge financial impact and also on profitability. So it's so much easier easier to look at prevention rather than to look at a curative intervention.
Based on your experience, is this an issue that is either on boardroom or exco agendas?
It is interesting when we do training at corporates in terms of corporate health and well-being and especially mental health being, I think everyone bought into the principle and the concept and understand how important it is and that people's mental health is really contributing to wealth as well for an organization. So the issue and the value is there. Unfortunately, what I've seen, if the financial director is not prepared to sign the check, it's not going to happen. And then the other problem is if the leader of organization, the leadership office or suite, do not also practice what they preach, do not talk about self-care and don't lead by example and don't respect boundaries and the boundaries between your private life and the work life, we don't see that. People won't speak about the mental health and they won't be open to access the care that they need if there's not an example from leadership side.
You've spoken about the shift to value-based healthcare. Could that improve outcomes in the very short term?
We believe so. Not more than in the short term, and maybe it's a phased approach. Currently in South Africa, we function from a fee-for-service model. There's some value-based strategies that have been rolled out, especially in ophthalmological care and in orthopedic care. But it is really a huge challenge, but it's a very exciting challenge where we do not look at fee-for-service and do not only look at let's fix something, but we really look at improving patients' outcomes throughout their lifespan and across the condition of contact. Not only to look at service volumes, but to enhance the patient experience, their satisfaction, their health outcomes, but also to equip them with a personal responsibility of buying in and being a partner in health. It's very important that we also eliminate inefficiencies and look at better operational ways to reduce cost in terms of long-term quality improvements. Now, maybe a stepwise approach is that some different financing models can be looked at, for example, capitation, until there's proper what we call bundled payments, where people are paid to manage a condition and not only a contact point.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Professor Renate Skooman, Head of Healthcare Leadership at the Stellenbosch Business School. And that's also MoneyWeb at midday for today. We are back tomorrow live at noon, then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.